DeMelo Roberts stage and studio on ArtsWatch. I do love serendipity. My next guest heard the podcast I did with author Heidi Durrow and found similarities from her own childhood as Heidi and I talked about growing up in a military family overseas. When I checked out my next guest's website, I discovered a series of articles she wrote detailing the history and accomplishments of African Americans in the fashion industry. Now, as a fan of shows like Project Runway and Making the Cut, I was eager to have a conversation with Rhonda P. Hill. Hill is an American fashion industry analyst, a curator, and founder of Edge Fashion Intelligence, and the publishing editor of EdgeExpo.com. Edge stands for Emerging Designers Get Exposed. It's an international platform dedicated to the artistic values, cultural significance, and sustainability through the exposure of emerging fashion designers. She recently published a series of articles titled A Study of Eight, The Untold American Story, which was featured on NPR's Here and Now. Hill also worked her way up since the 1970s as an African-American woman in the world of fashion. It's my sincere pleasure to welcome Rhonda P. Hill. Welcome to Stage and Studio on ArtsWatch, Rhonda.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
Well, you have an impressive career. And before we talk more about that and the study of eight, we had something else in common as children of fathers who were stationed in Japan.
That's right.
And I also had Japanese as my first language. So what was that early international upbringing? How did that fare for you?
You know, I was born in 1956, and according to a passport that I found of my mother's, who at the time when a woman was traveling with children, the three of us, my mother and my sister and I, were all together in the photo together for the passport. And what I saw was that it was stamped 1957. So I was there from 1957, so about, let's say, 6 months after I was born, until maybe 3 years or close to 3 years old. So I was there maybe 2.5 years, and I don't remember much. What I do remember was playing in the backyard with, I think at the time, officers' wives were able to have Japanese maids. And so I remember having someone in the house that was Japanese. And since I played with her all the time in the back, I must have picked up the language. And so when I came back to the States, my parents said, yeah, you were speaking Japanese. And of course, today I wish I could remember.
We have that in common because my dad actually said, you better stop speaking Japanese because we're in America now, you know. And so I totally forgot it, you know, because they were worried whether or not if I spoke English well enough.
Yes, yes.
So that's so wonderful. I mean, yeah, yes. It, you know, I remember it as really a happy time too because of going to the cherry blossom festivals and I don't know. It just seemed like a fun time, especially for children at that time. I think they really love children.
how old were you, Dime? How old were you?
Well, you know, it's hard to remember, but it was from 1961, I believe, I'm not sure, through 1964, because I very clearly remember, and this is aging me as well, but clearly remember how everyone in Japan was mourning JFK's assassination.
Oh.
And that was a pretty big deal.
Yes.
And I remember that,
right,
you know,
right.
And I remember how just the whole, you know, the whole neighborhood, the whole city was all about, you know, mourning,
yes,
you know, wearing white. And, you know, it was just very momentous time.
Yes.
So I do remember that very well. But it's hard. You know, the memories start to get a little fuzzy. But I'm so glad we have that in common.
Me too.
Rhonda, I am eager to launch into your essays of A Study of Eight because it is such a wonderful historic archive.
Yes.
And it examines Black contributions to the fashion industry from 1880 through the civil rights movement and a little bit beyond. What made you want to do this series?
You know, I've been wanting to do this for a long, long time. And every time I would think about doing something for Black History Month, I never allowed myself enough time to really do a good body of work. So the pandemic, I have to say, allowed me the time, the space to actually do this. And what really moved me along was of what we all witnessed last year was the injustices that were done to the marginalized communities and what happened to George Floyd. So I just felt like this was the time. I had the time, and this was the time to do it. I always wanted to elevate those voices, those hidden voices that we really didn't know about, especially when it comes to Black fashion makers who really did make a contribution to fashion. And I unpacked so much information that I didn't know. I unpacked information that I literally experienced and just didn't know the significance of it, being African-American. And it really was an amazing time to do it. I had the time. I allowed the time. I did the research, read a lot of books. I think a lot of us probably read during that time during the pandemic, but I read a lot of books on the subjects, did a lot of YouTube. And what I found was that the process for me was so extraordinary that sometimes it was disappointing to unpack some of the information. Sometimes it was dark. And I think it was because of who I am. And I was born in that time period, civil rights movement. And then I was lining up everything that I was studying against all the historical events, you know, like the passing of the Civil Rights Act in 1964, the assassinations, as you mentioned, you know. So I was lining everything up with my own events, being a military daughter moving around. And then on top of it was the current events that were happening at the same time. So all those emotions kind of came together. It's like I was doing the research on subjects that were unknown. I was learning a lot myself. I realized how much I was born in, within that time frame. And then on top of lining everything up and laying it up against the civil rights activities and milestones, we were going through a pandemic. We were going through social injustice, and we were going through voter suppression, you know, in lieu of the election last year. So yeah, so it was a tall task, but I'm really, really glad that I did it. It took me about 6 months to put it together.
I believe that. I totally believe that because it's so incredible and I learned so much, you know, and I encourage everybody to go to the link at this podcast page to see it. But let's talk a little bit more about that. You start off the series of pieces about the role of the cotton factory to fashion, and you talk about the Coleman Manufacturing Company story. Would you tell us about that?
Yes, I chose that story to lead because it really introduced discriminatory and oppressed labor practices, particularly amongst the African Americans at the time. And what was unique to it was that all the businesses, all the mills were really owned by white people, and they hired both Black and white people. But it was a lot cheaper to hire Black people, and particularly Black women. And the white community didn't like that. So I felt like it was, through my research, I felt like it was a good story to tell. Here again, you had oppression, you know, when it came to the Black community and the cheap labor practices and the white community protesting against that. But then on the flip side, you had at least one, and there was probably more than one, but there was one that was well-known, Coleman Manufacturing Company, that was Black-owned and operated. And they, of course, Black-owned and operated, and they hired Black people. And they didn't survive that long. They were only in business for about 6 years. And for obvious reasons, I'm sure they got ran out of town. But I just felt like I wanted to at least present that study, what took place during that in the late 1800s, you know, early 1900s, as far as the cotton mills and Black people.
Yeah, there was so much backlash against them too, wasn't there?
Yes,
You know, and they didn't stay in business very long.
No, 6 or 7 years. And the protests from the white community really probably made it very, very uncomfortable for them to be in business that long. And if you really think about just the economics and the business factor, you know, if he were to even ship bales of cotton, who would be his clients? You know, they would obviously cater, white would cater to white. So I can understand, you know, why, you know, there was a lot of good to it in trying to, you know, sustain that company, but it's understandable at the time why he had to go out of business.
Yeah, but that I found it very inspiring too. And I'm sure that, you know, it probably percolated in other realms, you know, and
yes,
other industries. So that was very, it was impactful that they did,
yes,
that, you know.
Yes.
Your second feature story is on W.E.B. Du Bois' exhibition at the 1900 World's Fair in Paris. And You state that that's the first time upwardly mobile Black Americans were depicted. And I have to say, the historical photos that you have up on your site of African-American women and men are just stunning.
Aren't they beautiful?
Just stunning photos.
Yes.
They really are.
Yes, yes. This was an interesting project. W.E.B. Du Bois, he was the one that started NAACP. He was an activist, a sociologist, a historian, civil rights activist, author. He earned his doctorate at Harvard. And he wanted to expose the Black community to who they are today. He wanted to mitigate the image that around the world, Black Americans were ex-slaves. So they were sharecroppers. You know, they were working in disadvantaged areas. What he wanted to do was show that we were lawyers and doctors and school teachers and business people, and that we were a middle class that was upwardly mobile. And the way he did this was he had these beautiful, beautiful portraits of African Americans dressed beautifully, hair, makeup, hats, jewelry. And he wanted everyone to understand that we too can acquire fine art. We too can and have nice homes. We too can have fine jewelry. So I thought that was pretty amazing. And the reason I selected that story is because the Black community has always leveraged the power of dress and appearance as a means to move forward, as a means to be recognized and included. So that image of Black people dressed like that and presented that way was very powerful in showing that the power of dress can change the perception of a segment of society, you know, uplifting and inspiring to those in the community. And those around the world were able to bear witness to the Black community that he was trying to depict. So it was an amazing kind of research project to kind of dig deeper. The nice thing about it is that it was very accessible through the Library of Congress. All those images are free to use through the Library of Congress. So it made it quite engaging. Another thing I wanted to point out about that piece is that, and he mentions it in one of the reasons why he did this, he wanted to show a range of African Americans as far as their look. And I think that's important, not only in the communities outside of African Americans, but inside of African Americans, because we tend to have an issue when it comes to colorism, the different levels of skin color and skin tones. So he made sure that he had a representation of different skin tones and hair textures. So, and I did the same thing when I curated those photos. I curated photos that had very, very white looking African Americans and dark looking African Americans.
I noticed that. And I think that is an important statement there. And I think it was important that Du Bois did that. And I have to wonder if it would have happened anywhere else but Paris at the time too, you know.
Right.
Because I don't know that it would have happened in this country, but it was important to break those stereotypes.
Yes.
I also want to point out that another feature you have is the first Black fashion designers, which included Elizabeth Hobbs Keckley, who's best known as Mary Todd Lincoln's dressmaker and confidant, Fanny Chris Payne, who was the premier dressmaker of Richmond, Virginia in the early 20th century, Cole Lewis, who designed the iconic wedding dress of Jackie Kennedy, mm-hmm. and Zelda Barber Wynn Valdez, who opened her own shop in 1948. I mean, for a designer to actually open their own store was
yes.
a pretty big deal,
yes,
too.
Very much so. Yes.
You know, a couture store. Yeah.
Yes, yes.
So tell us about the, you know,
okay.
how, you know, the importance of these women.
Well, this was actually the cornerstone of me doing the project. I wanted to elevate the pioneers of the Black fashion makers, the designers. And I did test this out a little bit earlier in the fall before I published these, just to see what the reaction would be. And the reaction was amazing. So I went ahead and really explored these four women. I have to say, Ann Cole Lowe, who's known for creating the wedding gown for Jackie Kennedy, her story is pretty amazing. And let me just kind of shed some light on this. She made the wedding gown, and she also made the wedding party's attire. And when she showed up the day to deliver, this is, I think it's one of her relatives in a latter generation was quoted in a book. When Anne showed up at the front door of Jackie Kennedy's home, they said to her that she had to go around to the service entrance to bring in all of these gowns, okay? And she looked at him and she says, "There won't be a wedding if I have to go through the back door." And so, of course, they allowed her through the front door. So I thought that was an amazing piece. All four of them were really, they really focused on kind of the more high society, if you will. High society as far as African Americans, but really high society in the white community, especially the earlier ones. Because Elizabeth Hobbs Keckley, who not only, I mean, obviously she was the dressmaker for Mary Lincoln all those years, but she also made dresses for other politician wives. Same thing with Fannie Crist Payne. Their market was really targeted to those that really could pay the bills, you know, white women who wanted to have a dressmaker. And many of them, when you look back at what they did, a lot of the fashion press, they speak highly of these women and the quality of what they make. And back then, they were defined as dressmakers and seamstresses. Today, they would be defined as designers. A few of them have gotten some attention in that respect to be labeled as designers, but they truly were the pioneers in that respect. Now, Zelda, what's interesting about Zelda is that she also, Hugh Hefner, the Playboy community, hired her to do the Playboy bunny costumes. So she's known for that. He commissioned her in 1958 and in 1968 in his Chicago, I guess, Playboy club, launched the first Playboy bunny costumes. So she's known for that. So yeah, very interesting, Diana.
Yeah, talk about iconic.
I know. And Ann Cole Lowe wow. also designed the Oscar dress for Olivia de Havilland in 1942. So they have a lot of credit. Yeah, we give them a lot of credit.
Yeah, there's a lot of milestones there. Well, and more milestones too. Now, I did not know that Mildred Blunt, who you also feature in mm-hmm. a different article, mm-hmm. was the first Black member of the Motion Pictures Costumers Union and known for her gorgeous hats.
Yes.
That are in two museums yes. around the country. Yes. But she also designed hats for Gone with the Wind
yes.
and so many other films, as yes. well as for famous clients like Marian Anderson and Gloria Vanderbilt. Yes. I mean, what a contribution to history, fashion history. And I did not know. I mean, she's primarily was a hat maker then, a hat designer.
Exactly. I love her story. You know, if I could just go back into time, I would love to have tea with her, an afternoon tea, and just talk to her. I really do like her story. She started working for a company, a hat company in New York called John Fredericks. And they didn't want to hire her because she was African-American, but she says, "Please give me a chance." And then they did. And in 1939, she had a beautiful body of work of these miniature hats. And she presented them at the World's Fair at the time. And the story goes that David Selznick's wife was at the World's Fair and saw her hats. And the hats really depicted the film, Gone with the Wind. So she told her husband and he got in touch with John Fredericks. And the history is that Mildred did make those hats. She made most of the hats that Scarlett O'Hara wore. However, she did not get credit for them. The credit went to the credit went to the quote unquote costume designer underneath the movie producer. But later on, the credit went to John Fredericks. So she never really got official credit other than today we're talking about it. So she's getting credit now. The other thing that's kind of unique just about that story, Gone with the Wind, is that, and I put this in the article, is that Hattie McDaniel she was the first African-American to get the Oscar for her supporting role in Gone with the Wind. And because of Jim Crow, the Jim Crow laws, she had to sit, her and her date had to sit in the back of the auditorium, you know, where they were accepting the award. So it's just kind of, it's such an irony, you know, she's winning an award, but yet because she's Black, she's sitting at the back of the bus. So
yeah, that's not irony. That's just, that's a travesty.
Yeah, travesty.
You know, that's
right.
Not irony. That's a travesty, you know, right. Because you win the Oscar. You're the first,
right.
First Black American to win the Oscar,
right.
First woman, you know, and
right.
It's like, you got to go through the back door. So,
yes.
You know,
yes.
that's insane.
Totally.
And you know, so much of this too, I mean, the people that we've been talking about have made important contributions, but it's been, you know, not as visible. It's like,
right.
You're uncovering this hidden history. But then you focus on another piece on the 60s and 70s and the first Black supermodels. Now, that's an important milestone because it's visibility, too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yes.
You know, so let's
yes.
Talk about the supermodels.
Well, up until this time, Black beauty had been denied to enter the space for so long. So finally, there was inclusion, respect, and recognition, and representation, although small, significant. And what I want to say about kind of the underlying theme amongst through the eight pieces is that this particular one showed how the power of fashion really neutralized the biases, because you can dress a white model or a Black model, but you're going to get the same outcome. You're going to get a fashion statement. And what was interesting about this is that because of the very troubling 60s, these women ended up on mainstream media cover. They were on the cover issues of mainstream media fashion magazines. Like when you line up, for example, in 1963, you had the assassination of Kennedy. You also had the assassination of Medgar Evers, the civil rights activist. And you had, of course, in 64, you had the passing of the Civil Rights Act. Well, in 65, that's when Danielle Luna graced Harper's Bazaar. Now, that was an illustration, not actual a photo of her, but still, that was her. And then in 1966, she was on the cover of British Vogue, her actual photo. But what's interesting about that, when you look at it, is she's got her hand over her nose and mouth and eyes. So here again, it's like the industry was saying, yes, you know, we want to have Black on the cover, but let's kind of make it a little bit subtle. But then they moved on in 68, another year of extraordinary events with the two assassinations, MLK and Kennedy. It was the same year that James Brown was fed up with this. So he came out with his song, Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud, his anthem, if you will. But later on that year, you had the cover of Ladies Home Journal was Naomi Sims. So, and then the following year, she graced the cover of Life magazine. And then it went on and on. And then, you know, years later was Beverly Johnson, who was on the cover of Glamour and then Vogue in 1974. So it took some time, but we finally made some headway with the supermodels gracing the cover.
I think that, yeah, it did take a long time, but it was such an important contribution. And then you devoted, also in the 70s, an article to the Battle of Versailles in 1974. And I recently watched the miniseries Halston on Netflix, and
oh, okay.
It featured that battle.
Oh.
And what a pivotal moment it was for American
yes.
fashion designers, because all the major designers were there, and they were celebrated, you know, and there were celebrities like Princess Grace, or Annie Warhol, Liza Minnelli, Josephine
yes.
Baker, but they also was a time when it was all about the art of design, you
mm-hmm.
know, and the way it was presented
mm-hmm.
and as well as in the clothes.
Mm-hmm.
But the very significant aspect of it is that out of 36 models, 10 were African-American.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so to have that kind of exposure,
it was amazing
for all the design world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Talk
yes.
a little bit more about that.
That was such a unique experience. And it was the Battle of Versailles was basically a fundraising event to raise money to save the Palace of Versailles, to restore it. So American designers were pitted against French designers to showcase, you know, what was new in fashion. And in the American lineup, we had one African-American designer, but out of the 36 models, there were 10 African-American models. And because it was a time where Black, it's because this was 1973, so it was a time when Black was considered beautiful, women were liberated, you know, art and music and societies, celebrity and fashion converged, you know, it's kind of like a groovy time of the year, a groovy time of during this period. And America was really never on the map when it came to fashion. But what America depicted in this particular show was one of designs and collections work that showcased freedom. And they were very relaxed and modern compared to the more stodgy French designs. But in addition to that, there was a minimalist to the presentation. And part of it was the staging, but the main part was really the African models. The models came out, I mean, all the models were fantastic, but the African models had such movement and presence and staging, and they twirled and they did all these things, and the clothes were beautiful and the clothes were free. I mean, it was just, it just blew everybody away. And when I did this, the research on this, I saw a lot that was on YouTube. And I have to say, because they didn't really document this back then, thank God for the oral history, because the oral history is what really documented. A lot of those models are still alive, and the designers are still alive. So it was nice to see and hear what everyone had to say, and everyone contributed, the African-American models, as the ones who kind of like brought the show. There was a New York photographer, Bill Cunningham. I don't know if you're familiar with him, but Bill Cunningham, very famous photographer for the New York Times, who actually photographed just people in the streets for years and years and years. He passed away some years ago. He was there. And what he said, I loved what he said. He says, Black people transformed the perception of American fashion. He says, it was such a game changer for this event on so many levels, on the fashion level one, but we were coming to grips and coming to reality with how beautiful African Americans really are and what they can contribute to the industry.
Well, you know, I mean, speaking of the industry, did you start working in the industry like in the late 70s or so and through the 80s and 90s?
Yes, good question. I was recruited to work for Macy's when I was finishing up school there at the University of Arizona in Tucson. And it was back then, it was a kind of a big deal to get into retail, to get and to become a buyer. And the companies literally went around to the schools and recruited people right from the schools, the seniors. So I started right after college working for Macy's they called us executive trainees. So I was an executive trainee being trained to be a buyer. And I became a buyer in 1983. And it was a great starting ground. I think times were different back then though. Different from as my career progressed, it started off a little bumpy when it came to advancing. So I think America was still trying to get used to Black people in the workforce. And it was not that common to have Black people in the fashion, retail, buying part of the business. It wasn't common at all. So I was unique in that respect. And as I was doing this project, you know, it took me back to those moments when, you know, I could have become I could have been promoted to buyer years before I did, but I was passed over. I was passed over because I was Black, but I prevailed and just kept at it and got a really coveted job. So,
yeah, I don't think that especially younger generations really understand as much how the system worked against you. You know,
yes,
it was like so commonplace that you would make less, that you wouldn't be promoted because, and not just a woman, but because you're also Black, right?
Right.
And so, so all of that was very commonplace and nobody actually, I mean, I remember so many times, nobody actually thought it was a big deal if even if you mentioned it at the time.
Right.
Because if
so
you did mention it, you risked losing your work.
Exactly.
It was easy to be fired for that reason, for just asking questions.
That is so true. It's almost like you're numb from it. At least I felt like I was numb from it. You know, when I got passed over, I was just like, okay, I'm just going to keep trying and working hard and I will get the job finally. So yes, you're right. You're absolutely right.
Well, you persevered. I mean, you worked through the 90s and with really top companies like Disney and Adidas. And Levi Strauss. So, you know, you should be commended for persevering, and working your way, very difficult,
right?
Working your way through, you know, up to the top, right?
Yes.
Because it wasn't like an easy road at all.
No, it wasn't. It got easier. It got, it got better. It got, let's just say it became more accepting of talent that just happened to be Black in the workforce, you know? So it became more accepting depending on who you worked with. Levi Strauss & Company was a very good example that walked the talk when it came to diversification within their employment practices. So,
well, that's good. That's good to hear. Yeah. I want to also mention that you end your series of eight with the story of Willie Smith, the designer for Williwear. Mm-hmm. And what was his importance to you that you wanted to include him for the final piece?
You know, there were quite a few designers at that time, Black designers that were making, you know, important statements. But Willie Smith, to me, was so unique in that he was probably the most commercially successful designer because he had a history of being in Macy's and Bloomingdale's. You know, it was just automatic. His line continued to be bought and sold. So he really made a presence in the retail community. That was part of it. But what I liked mostly about him, what I discovered, is that his collaboration with other art disciplines was very, very, very unique. And he was sought after to collaborate from an artistic standpoint. So for example, Spike Lee wanted Willie Smith to design for him in his movie School Days. So he was credited as a costume designer for a segment of the Spike Lee School Days movie. Boy, he did so much with the arts. He developed a t-shirt program. He was the first to capture t-shirts on art on t-shirts. And so that was kind of its own like fashion, you know, trend or fashion wave. So he was the first to do that and incorporate, you know, key artists like Keith Haring, for example, on t-shirts. He also designed the suiting for the groomsmen for Carolyn Kennedy. I mean, so he was just doing a lot. But when it came to the art community, he did so much. He did a lot with the dance theater groups, you know, making costumes for them and doing a lot of cross-discipline and cross-collaboration. And he inspired everybody to do this. And it was back in the day in the 70s and 80s when New York was just kind of, it was very hot and very experimental. And you had Warhol and Basquiat and all of them. And they were all together doing these collaborative, you know, cross-discipline kinds of art projects. So Willie Smith was just amazing. He was amazing in that regard, you know, because most people stay in their lane, but he was out of his lane, but yet still grounded in fashion. Another good example is, I don't know if you sewed at all in your life, but you may have been familiar with Call and Butterick.
Oh yeah,
pattern houses.
I was terrible at it though.
I was terrible, so terrible too.
I made the ugliest apron for home ec class, I have to say.
Well, you're not alone. I made a really bad skirt.
They made us do a nightgown too. And boy, that was horrible. No, but I respect people who can, you know, make a pattern and be able to create something wonderful and to actually sew it too. I mean, I just think it's a miracle to be able to.
Oh, yeah. I can't
do it.
I know.
I can't vision it. I can't do any of it. So, you know, I just want to point out too to our listeners is that, yes, those are the series of eight is one section of this amazing website that you have created, this platform for emerging designers, but also you focus on sustainability. And so there's just so much to browse through. So I encourage people to go to edgeexpo.com. Now, what made you wanted to create that platform? What was your impetus for that?
Well, when I was buying, I appreciated the fashion business around me was one that was very conscious, and clothes that were made were of quality. And I may have taken it for granted back then, but I noticed that over the years, you know, things got out of hand. There was too much lack of poor quality, too much of the same. And the designers, I felt that didn't have voice or were not even getting into these boutique stores were not there. They were just overlooked. When I was a buyer, even though I may have bought from established brands, like I bought French Connection, I bought Esprit, I bought Guess, you know, those are very established brands. I also bought what I called up and coming or emerging designers, emerging brands. And they did very, very, very well. They would sell out. But that was what was missing from the infrastructure of fashion today at the time when I started this. So I decided to to build a platform to expose them, to expose their work. It's important to get back to meaningful and purposeful designs that have artistic output, where designers and brands are having sustainable practices. So I just felt like I needed to get their voices heard, because I wasn't seeing it as a consumer. You know, I had a hard time shopping beyond the established brand infrastructure of the industry.
And I have to wonder what sustains you, because, I mean, you also do, you know, have been doing exhibitions of design work, and as well as the Edge Expo site. So what sustains you as you, and what are we looking forward to for future pieces, you know, that you write about, or future exhibits? What's ahead for you?
Well, the cornerstone of the Edge platform is really having these wonderful conversations with designers all over the world and exposing their meaningful collections. And at some point, it would be amazing if we could see their work in an art institution kind of fashion, exhibit their work. It's one thing to see fashion go down the runway. 10, 20 minutes, it's over, you forget about it. It's another to see fashion in a museum, in a gallery that's up for 2 or 3 months, where you can come and get educated about it. You can build programming around it. And if you're a buyer, you actually can speak to the designer and you can really look at the clothes. You can really study. And that's something that we just don't have, you know, across the globe. It's hit and miss. And those fashion institutions that do have it, they usually have an infrastructure that just focuses on the historical aspect, maybe a retrospective of Christian Dior or YSL, but not contemporary fashion, not contemporary designers. So I'd love to do what I do on an ongoing basis, where it's physical. It's more of an exhibition. And that's, I continue to lay the groundwork for that. So that's coming. And one day I'd like to put out a book, but those are projects down the road.
I hope you do.
Thank
I hope you.
You
do.
Thank you.
I hope you become a judge on Project Runway too.
Yes.
I could see you doing that. I could totally see you doing that.
Yeah.
So I encourage everyone to follow the links of this podcast page to explore the multifaceted and fascinating site of edgeexpo.com and to travel through history with the fascinating 8 feature stories of A Study of 8, The Untold American Story. Rhonda P. Hill, thank you for this enlightening conversation, for your great work. I've learned a lot. So thank you.
Thank you, Demay. Thank you.
It's been great to talk with you. That's it for Stage and Studio on Arts Watch this week. You can always catch the show on stageandstudio.org and Arts Watch at orartswatch.org, and also subscribe on any podcast platform. So like us on facebook.com/stage_studio. Till the next conversation, I'm Demay Lowe Roberts.